My life. Amazing. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With
amazing.
My life.
Amazing strangers.
Hello to you, wherever you are in the world today. This is episode number 12345. Yeah, episode number 6. Where has the time gone of my life with amazing strangers? I'm your host, Gary Robinson. This is the podcast that is all about care, the world of care, looking at care in the future, where we've come from in terms of the history of care, and it's all about care in the UK. Thank you for joining me. Now, special guest today, not only a guest, but also a pal, full disclosure on that. So not exactly a stranger to me. I've known him for years, but he's also very, very experienced in the world of care. And I'm also really chuffed, I have to say, that he's agreed to be one of the two co-hosts of this particular podcast, along with Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk. So David Wilson-Wynn is the man I'm speaking to today. David, over 18 years of experience. He's highly experienced in care, working in many roles throughout the years in this particular sector. He's currently enjoying his role as senior dementia consultant at the Dementia Services Development Centre within the University of Stirling in Scotland. And in this interview, you'll hear about David's years of experience, 18 years, like I said, within the field of health and social care. This conversation, I've got to say, is passionate, it's fearless, and it's honest, as David is, absolutely through and through. And once I'd heard the conversation, and of course we'd been through what we call in the business pre-production, post-production, all that sort of stuff, it suddenly dawned on me that this is a fantastic listen if you are working in care, or indeed if you're thinking about a career, an extremely rewarding career in care. Have a listen to this. It's just 40 minutes out of your life, and it's going to be so invaluable for you. So here we go. I started by asking David about his current role at the University of Stirling. Have a listen to this.
So part of my role is to look at teaching, whether that be carers, people living with dementia themselves. It could be NHS boards, private care providers, Scottish Government, care inspectorate, you name it. The motivation around it is because, like any job, you experience both good and bad in positions that I have. And I would be lying if I had said I have never experienced any elements of bad practice or anything throughout my career so far. Unfortunately, I have, and that has been the driver, to be honest. That's been my motivation to change, to influence, to mentor and support, provide people with the tools and the qualifications, the confidence to be able to provide really effective person-centered care. But not just because some of my jobs, for example, the job within the private care provider, although I was the dementia lead for the organisation, it was about well-being of all residents, regardless of whether they had a diagnosis of dementia or not. So to me, it was about providing consistent high-level quality of care. But although coming up against barriers is just an inevitable part of working within the care sector, for me, it's about when I review elements of bad practice that I have done, that's the driver for me to say I could be playing my part in ensuring that this doesn't happen again. And yeah, that is my motivation, I would say. Yeah.
You're clearly passionate and excellent at your job, but I imagine in some of the positions you've been in, because you're not a shy guy, and I know that you do talk up against anything that you disagree with or any injustices that you may see. Maybe some of your employers perhaps have seen you as a wee bit of a thorn in the side in the past.
Without a doubt. I think particularly when you look at elements of positions that I've gone into whereby the culture hasn't been perhaps the best. Everybody's been set in their ways, and all of a sudden this guy comes in and is wanting us to do this, that, and the next thing that we've never even heard of. So just take what he says with a pinch of salt, really. But I kind of view that as a motivation to help play my part to improve the culture or to help change the culture for the better. But a very wise person once told me that you'll never change the world overnight. But sometimes just a small, consistent drip feed effect. Don't preach to people about what you're wanting to do. Just go and do it so that they can see for themselves the change. So when it came to things like working within a ward whereby, or working within a care home where I'd walk in and I would see people not really engaging, even with each other, let alone staff members and those responsible for their care. It was other things like just sitting around watching the telly or sleeping in the chair and seeing right in front of my eyes the sheer diminishing of someone's quality of life, but also having to be that person to be the person's voice and say, surely we can do better than this. So that's when things changed about walking into a hospital ward and seeing patients that were living with dementia who were presenting with consistent distress, but walking down the corridor of the hospital ward and seeing them with headphones on, listening to a playlist. For some staff, this was too much. Like, no, it's getting them all hyperactive. It's getting them all animated, i.e. I'm going to have to do more here, as opposed to I quite like the fact that patients just sit, they watch the telly, they maybe do the occasional bit of colouring in, they get up and they walk about, but I don't really have to do too much. Whereas my viewpoint is from the minute you walk into a hospital, a care home, or even someone's own home, to the minute you leave, you're responsible for that person. You're responsible for all aspects of their care. And sometimes just even a 5-minute conversation can help improve someone's quality of life and be that connection. But you are right. There's been occasions whereby people have kind of viewed me as, oh, he's a little upstart and he's just trying to cause trouble. Whereas I view it, I know what my principles are and what my ethics are and my approach to care. And it's that whole philosophy of I just keep my fingers crossed and say to myself, I hope someone will be like that with me. I hope someone will think outside the box. So what's been his life story? What music does he like? What was his routine prior to coming into the hospital? And is there some way in which I can support him in which to maintain that? But just maintain his identity. Who is David? Whereas I think sometimes people become a little bit too complacent of, I'll just treat everybody the same because that's the best way of, again, a word I hate, managing the situation as opposed to supporting the situation.
We both work in an industry that's very heavily regulated, and yeah, and every organisation has policies and procedures, those two P words.
Yeah.
And I'm new into the business, certainly into my organisation, into the world of care. You're streets ahead, and I love your philosophy and your thinking. How do you balance the policies and procedures stuff that actually primarily, it does protect individuals, but it protects the organization and treats somebody as a human being? Because I have a saying that we're not making widgets in a widget factory. We're dealing with human beings. So how do you balance the organizational policies and procedures with treating people with love and care and treating them as human beings?
But it's a really interesting point because I have always felt really strongly about what some people would term as a very basic human rights-based approach to care. And that is, what are our fundamental human rights? What do we have the right to do as an individual? But my view and my philosophy is, why should that stop just because I have dementia? Or why should that stop just because I'm living in a care home or I'm in a hospital environment? There are huge issues between what I would empower people to do is a person-centred human rights-based approach to care. But legislation gets in the way of it at some point. And it's a very kind of taboo subject that nobody wants to talk about. But I am a huge advocate for this sense of, and the importance around the sense of touch when it comes to providing care. And I was near enough heartbroken when I would deliver training within a care home and people would say to me, but are you allowed to touch people? And I'd be flabbergasted by saying, I'm sorry, if we ever get to a point where someone, if they choose and you choose that walking down the corridor and holding their hand or giving somebody a cuddle because they're upset or giving somebody a cuddle because it's lovely to see them, if that person likes that type of thing, fair enough. But if we ever get to a point where someone along the line says, no, 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 all that has to stop, I'm done. I wouldn't work in the sector because I couldn't do my role without that. There's this huge grey area around the right to intimacy. As human beings, we have the right to intimacy. But all of that stops the minute someone walks into a care home, because we can't police that. Legislation stops us being able to look at a husband and wife where a gentleman has dementia. He doesn't have capacity, perhaps, say, but his wife wants to spend some private time alone with him in a room. Although we would support that, and people should support that, if then a disclosure was made by the wife about some form of intimacy between the two, boom, huge red flags. No, you shouldn't have done that. No, this is, I'm going to have to put an adult support protection concern in, blah, 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 blah. As opposed to an approach whereby, why do we not advocate for what was mutually consenting couples in the past and support them to still have that time together, on the provision that it doesn't cause either party distress. But it's a subject that nobody wants to talk about, and everybody just kind of pushes away to the side. I was responsible in one of my roles for developing aspects of policy. And it's really, really difficult because, like you say, we're regulated. We have health and social care standards. We have regulatory framework that care providers, whether it be care at home and care home, are inspected against. The good thing is that when it comes to looking around, for example, like so the new dementia strategy that's just been published in May this year, they're looking more at, does this framework still work? Is it still person-centred? Does it advocate for a human rights-based approach? And there were times that when I was looking at how to best create policy, I'd never sit in a room just on my own or with another colleague. I'd speak to families. I'd speak to residents. I'd speak to people living with dementia, because they are the best ones that can influence policy. There is no point in me making up a load of bullet points on what makes for meaningful engagement. I'm better to speak to someone that lives it day in, day out, of what is it like to live in a care home and what do you want from your care? Now, each person will be different, but there are themes. There can sometimes be a thread throughout that whereby, actually, you know what, every single person that I've spoken to this morning would just appreciate being prompted to, when it's sunny, when it's raining, when it's windy, regardless, take me outside and let me walk. And or even better, walk with me and chat to me about my family, chat to me about the job I did, all these kind of things. But it's really difficult. And some people don't necessarily want to challenge policy, and some people don't want to challenge procedure, particularly if it's procedure that's been in place for a long time. But these are the people that do are the ones that then go on to help shape practice. They help go on to shape policy for the future. And the piece of work that I'm doing within the University of Stirling at the moment is looking at curriculum for nursing and paramedic students. They are our future. They will be providing care to perhaps you and I one day. I want them to walk away feeling fully equipped, confident and competent to be able to deliver the very best care, but also the type of care that you and I want. It's really important.
It's a very interesting road that we're going down here. And I think there were some comparisons with the corporate world here. So in a previous life, I was lucky enough to do training, around comms, around communication, internally and externally in the corporate world. And I always felt that if you really wanted to know what was going on within your business, within your organization, speak to the receptionist, speak to the people on the front line. Don't make decisions behind a closed door in a boardroom without doing some form of consultation. I'm getting the impression from you, David, that that's your train of thought for going forward in terms of care in the future.
Without a doubt, because I think for some things, the reason that I've kind of always viewed things therapeutically and more kind of non-pharmacologically in relation to dementia care is because we've relied on a biomedical approach for generations, and it's not worked. And that aspect of practice, although it has its place, a biomedical approach has its place in practice, but it shouldn't form 80% of it, and it never should have. But the over-reliance on things like medication to help support people living with dementia who are presenting with distress. Medication is not the best way to go. It's not the best ethical way. It's not the most person-centered way. And I have worked for, most certainly for the past, I would say, 10 years to set out to prove the point of the benefits of a therapeutic-based intervention compared to a biomedical intervention. But the situation that I often see is when it comes to things like conferences, care conferences, for example, we see an awful lot of Dr. So-and-so and Professor So-and-so and, you know, CEO, Deputy CEO, delivering presentations about care, delivering talks about what they want from their organisational structure, their target, their organisational plan. Whereas if it were me, and there was a care congress, say, for example, held within my city of Dundee, I'd get a load of carers and I'd give carers the opportunity. You've got a captive, you've got a listening audience. Tell us what it's like. Tell me what your average day looks like and what you would want to see. What would you want to change? And that should always be the driver. That should always be the driver. And those who experience care. The as I say, the new dementia strategy, part of that was the development of it, it involved people living with dementia. What do they want for their care? What do they want in the future? And although this is a 10-year strategy, what does that mean for us in 15 years' time? What does it mean for us in 20 years' time? And I've always viewed it as, I've always been really fortunate that mentors that I've worked alongside have given me the opportunity to air my thoughts. Well, actually, you know what, David was speaking to me about something a minute ago, and I think we should give him the opportunity to perhaps say, as opposed to viewing it as, well, actually, to be honest with you, David, no, because you're not a nurse. So, you know, it's only nurses that are involved in this meeting. So, I mean, you can tell me about it, and if I get the opportunity to do so, then fine. I'm also aware that it could be that care assistant. It could be that domestic. It could be that receptionist. It could be an admin that has the most groundbreaking idea of how to influence practice. And I was once involved in a care home that was going through a really, really difficult time. And I got speaking to the handyman in this care home, lovely guy. And he said, every time I used to go in, he would say, well, how are things, Dave? And what's the latest? And blah, blah, blah. And I'd say, okay, I mean, it's the usual kind of thing. It's the sector's just, you know, it's on its knees because of staffing and staff retention, etc. And out of the blue, he disclosed to me that he was a retired chief superintendent in the police and was at one point responsible for literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of police and civilian staff. And I remember sitting with him in the office and I went, just out of pure curiosity, what would you do? And he said, why are you asking me that? And I said, well, why wouldn't I? Because you've got 30, 35 years worth of experience at a really high level. Has anybody ever asked you before? And he went, well, no, because Jings, I'm just a handyman. So they would view this man as just the handyman. And I'd always say, whenever I was delivering training or whatever in a care home, and somebody would say, well, you know, I'm Joan and I'm just a carer. And I would sit with a colleague sometimes, and this particular colleague would always chip up, you're not just anything. Your role is absolutely vital. But I think what it illustrated was that point of, there was a man with decades of experience, but what people saw in front of them was a handyman.
I heard an interview on the radio the other day, and I hear this a lot. And the quote was something along the lines of, and it was a lady who's working in care.
Yeah.
And she said, I don't do it for the money, clearly.
Yeah.
I do it because I love the job. And she, you know, she'll work extra hours, won't get paid, goes over and above, make mm-hmm. sure that all the people she is supporting, caring for, make sure that their needs are met. It seems to me that to be an effective carer, you've yeah. got to have the genes for it, which is the care gene.
Yeah.
Can money buy that? You know, would increasing wages possibly help with retention? But would it attract more people? Would it attract the real hardcore people that we need to make change?
Yeah and no. I think higher salaries, higher hourly rates, for example, for a carer would make the job more appealing. Of course it would, but It's always been a really difficult thing for me that when I go onto a website and I see that a carer, you know, a care assistant in a care home, £10 an hour, £10.50 an hour, and I go, okay. And then I scroll down and I see a job, and I don't exactly know what this involves, so perhaps I'm maybe speaking out of turn here, but I would see a job where it would just have joiner's mate, and it would be £35 an hour. Now, by no way am I offending people that have a trade, because it's vital. But who's the one with the high levels of responsibility? Who's the one that's looking after another human being? I always remember sitting with someone in HR in an organisation, and they said about staff retention, and they said, you know, I dismissed the point very quickly, because I thought, well, I don't think I really agree with that. I can see what you're getting at. But she said, why is it that people apply for a job as a carer and they know the salary, they know the rate they're going to be getting, but then when the stress of the job starts and it's maybe not going the way that they would like it to go, and they leave, and at their exit interview you say to them, why are you leaving? I'm not paid enough. But you were paid enough to apply. And I get that. I think the other thing that I suppose absolutely needs to be said is I can't teach someone how to care. And a job that I kind of missed out when I was saying about my roles is for a year just prior to COVID, I was a regional clinical trainer for a private care at home organisation. And I faced a lot of issues within that post, because I was responsible for induction of new carers, nurses, to this organisation. And it was after 5 days, it was myself, it was me that had to sign on the dotted line that I was happy enough with a particular individual, that they had engaged well over the past 5 days, they had passed all the assessments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would sign on the dotted line, boom, there you go. You have your job as a carer, now go and make a difference. But what would happen is we'd maybe start off with 10 on the Monday, and you were lucky if I would still have six, seven by the Tuesday morning. Because within the first day, I'd be able to ascertain, no, I don't like your approach. If you're finding it difficult enough to engage with me as the trainer, you don't stand a chance within the community, particularly if it's someone that can't necessarily communicate to you. But at the same time, there are occasions whereby I know that when I first walked into that job as a care assistant, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Not a clue. But because of good mentors and good support, they helped morph and they helped shape my practice and my thoughts, how I dealt with particular situations. So they could teach you that, but that genuine empathy, compassion, but also humour that comes with care, having to work in care, you can't really teach that. It needs to be within the person. And that desire to want to go out and make a difference, I would say.
My life. Amazing. My life.
My life. Amazing. My life.
David Wilson-Wing, along with Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk, are my new co-hosts of My Life with Amazing Strangers. And more from David in the forthcoming weeks. Now, talking of Dr. Zeedijk, Suzanne leads the discussion in episode 7. That's the next one on the horizon, looking at corporal punishment through the lens of fierce curiosity. The content of the next podcast is moving. It's sometimes raw. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to listen to be honest, as it holds up a mirror to a time when people of a certain age, like me and perhaps you, were physically punished at school in an atmosphere of, well, what could be described as fear and ignorance, to be frank. Yet it was accepted as the norm. So the old adage of "it never did me any harm" will certainly be put to the test in the next episode with Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk. Until then, take care of yourself and, of course, others. From me, Gary Robinson. Bye-bye.